I'd like to ask you a question. What is the very first dream recorded in the Bible? Don't look down and look on your cell phone. What's the very first dream where God gave someone a dream so that he would understand a message? And what is the message that dream conveyed? How many think it's Joseph and his dreams? Genesis 28, 29, 30. You'd be wrong. It's Genesis chapter 20. Let's turn over there to one of several men, the first men in the Bible, named Abimelech. Now, Abimelech is probably a good Bible name. There are not many people I know in modern days named Abimelech. But this message was very clear. The lesson was very clear. And the man who received the dream got the message. Genesis chapter 20 and verse 1. Abram journeyed from there south, went to Kadesh and Shur, and stayed in Gerar. Abraham said to Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister," or said of her. And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So she was up in age, as we consider age, probably in her 70s, maybe a little older, and yet she was still very attractive. I would say in that case, my wife is a modern-day Sarah. A lot of people think she's 20 years or better younger than she is. I still think she is, of course. And I don't miss too many chances to tell her how young and pretty she looks. So, although she doesn't like this little hair growth I've got on my face, she'd give me an ultimatum that once we're back from Egypt, it has to go. I'm not sure what the ultimatum is, but we'll see. Anyway, we are leaving in a few weeks for that wonderful trip. But let's go back to the Bible here. God came to Abimelech in a dream by night. This is the first recorded dream in the Bible, and said, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." So what is the message? If you commit adultery, I will kill you. So is adultery serious in God's eyes, or is it just, you know, like shaking hands, waving goodbye, going to lunch, like people consider it today? Verse 5, "Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she even herself said, 'He is my brother.'" Was sort of half true, because they were half brother, half sister. "In the integrity of my heart and innocence of my hands, I have done these things." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that you did it in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." It didn't say sinning against Abraham. That was her husband. God said, no, that would be a sin against him. And, of course, the rest of the story is about Abimelech making amends for that, and Abraham, I think, learning a little bit of a lesson. The story of the Scriptures is very clear from beginning to end that sexual sin, adultery, fornication, out of marriage, is a sin against God and something he truly hates. And those who get involved in it will pay a very serious penalty in this life, and perhaps not even have the one to come. But let's go over to Genesis chapter 34. This is not one of those subjects where there's an out, where there are circumstances where it somehow is excused. Here we have the story of Dinah, the only recorded daughter of Israel, probably the only daughter because she's listed in the names of those who go into Egypt later when Joseph had been made right under Pharaoh in Egypt. But this account says in chapter 34, "Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land." Now notice, she told her dad, "I'm going to go visit with some other girls." All of us that have had daughters understand that. "Dad, a bunch of us girls are going somewhere tonight. We're going for pizza." And then I had asked one of my daughters, "Well, how come this guy that's interested in you is always there when you're having pizza?" Because maybe it's not just the daughters. Maybe it's kind of a way of getting, you know, mixed company together without any supervision. But I'm sure none of you have ever had that experience with any of your daughters or sons, right? Heads are nodding, so I understand that. Young girls are young girls. "Shechem said to the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, when he saw her, and took her and lay with her and violated her." So this apparently happened very quickly. "His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke kindly to her." So he had a good line. He was speaking very nice things. He understood flattery. He understood a woman's need to be loved, to be complimented, to be accepted. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor and said, "Get me this young woman as a wife." You see, back then, a young woman who was not married was under the protection of her father until her father gave her away in marriage, and then she was under the protection of her husband and that family. Now we just let them turn 18 or even younger and turn them loose to the wolves and then hope that the wolves don't eat them or damage them or hurt them or kill them in the meantime before they finally get married. So our society has changed. So Jacob heard that he defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now, Jacob's reaction is not recorded, except that obviously he would have been very upset. Now, his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. So he didn't say anything. Then his sons came in from the field, and these were older brothers. Now, any of you men who were raised with a younger sister might identify with the reaction of some of these young men. My brother and I raised a younger sister, and in the years when we were living with my grandmother and basically were not without a home, but were without manly protection in the house, we had to sometimes defend my little sister. And it was unfortunately something my little sister got to understand she could use to cause trouble, which she occasionally did. None of you had sisters like this, I'm sure. But when she came home one time, I think she must have been about first grade, second grade, and she was crying because her red stockings she was wearing were all torn, and she cried to my grandma that some boy had pushed her down on the grade school playground. And my grandma yelled, "Chucky, Rex, get down here." So we were in trouble. We get down here. She says, "You go to school tomorrow, and you tell that boy, and you teach him he's never going to touch that girl again. Do you understand? You protect her." I'm not sure what we did. I think we scared him, pushed him down. I don't think we hurt him very much. But, you know, she had two big older brothers, and we protected our sister. And I could tell you a lot of other stories of me protecting my little sister. That's what these guys did. We cannot turn young girls loose because they are the most vulnerable things in the world. So here we have Jacob telling his sons. The sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were very grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. You don't hear that in modern day entertainment, do you? So you know the story. They pretended that they would, this is basically two guys trying to con each other. So we have Simeon and Levi, the second and third sons of Israel, and they are pretending they're going to make this relationship go. They say all you have to do is have your male circumcised. But now the sons of Shechem, they said, "Well, let's go ahead and get married and let them get married. We'll marry your sons and marry your daughters. And before long, we will own everything they have." They were going to steal everything that God had blessed Jacob with. And at this point, he would have had a very large number of herds, of sheep and of goats and of other possessions. So we have this basically two dishonest relationship, two parties entering into this dishonest relationship. And of course, what happened was, the two men that were not hurting because they hadn't gotten circumcised, they had years before and they were all healed up, they went in with their swords and they killed all of the sons, all of the males who were in that tribe. Who knows how many it was? It may have been 100 or less. Verse 30, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites," because he knew he was living there as a traveler through, as a guest. "Since I am few in number and they will gather themselves together against me and kill me, I shall be destroyed, my household and I." What was their reaction? They said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot? Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" And of course, the answer was no, they should not. So they felt very justified. And there is nothing else said of Dinah except she's in a list of names much later in Genesis. But it's sad that the story is the only account of her. I want to go back to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 gives us the result of man's sinning, of Satan the devil in the form of a snake going to Eve and saying, "Why don't you go ahead and eat from the tree that God has prohibited? which of course she did, and then she took to her husband. She fell for the first lie, and a very terrible lie, one that has been told many, many times since. So when God came to them, he read to them their penalty. And what was the penalty that Eve was to suffer? Genesis chapter 3, it's beginning in verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. So she would see a lot of heartache during her life, and she would have children that would be in pain. Verse, the second part of the verse, in pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, the King James and the New King James don't give the entire meaning as clearly as some other translations. What it really means is she would have a desire for her husband. And that desire to have a relationship, that desire of young ladies to have a man in their life, has led them to compromise, has led them to disobey God, has led them into lives of sin from which they have paid a severe penalty. Some other translations, the ASV says, your desire shall be to your husband. The BBE version says, your desire will be for your husband. You shall desire to have one. CEV, the Christian Education version, I think it is, it may be a different one, but CEV version says, you will still desire your husband, and he will rule over you. Young's Little Translation says, toward your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you. Now, there are many prohibitions against relations outside of marriage in the Bible. Very, very clear. This is not something there's a great deal of argument about. We all know thou shalt not commit adultery is the seventh commandment. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 14 and Deuteronomy 5 and verse 18. I want to go over now, though, to Leviticus chapter 18. Leviticus chapter 18 gives us a little more detail in the just how serious this issue is in the eyes of God. There's no other verse that says if you break this or you violate this, that you are actually defiling yourself or defiling the other person involved. Leviticus chapter 18, in verse 20, moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. You shall not set any of your descendants to pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God, for I am the Lord. This entire chapter, of course, lists a number of sins that will get a nation kicked off of their real estate that God has given to them. And we see that happening right before our eyes in the nation in which we live. But you shall not defile yourself with your neighbor's wife. And, of course, that is the subject of much entertainment, has been for many, many years. Things have changed so much in the past 50 years in what we see on television, what is being able to be viewed. I'm old enough to remember when I Love Lucy was on, and Lucy and Desi had twin beds in their bedroom. They were not allowed to be seen in anything but full clothes and sleeping in twin beds with pajamas that went up to their into their, you know, obviously complete suits, like complete army uniforms or something. Now, of course, what you could see on television has come so far that it's not something you would even want to see. But the attitude is that our nation today is that God doesn't matter, and what God said can be simply ignored. So we have this prohibition just in Leviticus chapter 18. Over in chapter 20 and verse 10, Leviticus 20 and verse 10, very plainly, the man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he who commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. As you read these scriptures, it becomes very obvious, beginning with Abimelech, that God is very serious about this subject. This is not a subject with which there is a lot of wiggle room, making excuses, or trying to pretend that it doesn't say what it says. The adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. But of course, you'll only hear that in the times in which we live, and sadly, the modern day culture, modern pop culture in which we live, has eroded the understanding, the clear understanding of God's commands on this subject in the minds of far too many people in the Church of God. Let's go over to 2 Samuel chapter 13. 2 Samuel chapter 13. When I read this over, I sometimes think, how I wish we had more young ladies that understood this as clearly as this young lady did. Now, certainly she was violated, but what she said was absolutely true, The answer is no, this type of evil should not be done in our sight or in God's sight or in all of Israel. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1, after this, Absalom obviously was a kind of a psychopathic individual. He was very dishonest. He was a good actor. He was obviously narcissistic, and he didn't care about the consequences of his actions on other people. So Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Amnon was so distressed over his sister Tamar, the word should be infatuated, but apparently it was infatuated to a high degree, that he became sick, for she was a virgin. She was still under her father's protection and would someday be given in marriage. It was improper for Amnon to do anything to her. He should have had permission. He should have done it the right way, but he did not. Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shechem, David's brother. Now, Jonadab was a very crafty man. The Bible is such a great study in human nature. Every type of human nature, behavior, personality type, whatever you want to call it, is clearly given to us in the Scriptures. All we have to do is look at them and understand as we read the lesson God wants us to discern from them. So we've all had friends like Jonadab, at least wise, if we haven't, we're very lucky, but Jonadabs are still out there, people with very, very bad advice. He said to him, "Why are you the king's son becoming thinner day by day? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." So Jonadab said to him, he didn't give him good advice. He didn't say, do this the right way, go talk to the king, or whatever process they would have had to go through to become betrothed and then later married. Jonadab said, "Lie down on your feet, on your bed, pretend to be sick, and when your father comes to see you, say, 'Please let my sister Tamar come and give me food and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. Now, this is one of those cases where, you know, his character is very obvious. When young ladies have come to visit and to talk about, you know, maybe some young man they like or they're interested in them, I sometimes will go through my list of red flags. Does he do this? Have you ever caught him doing that? And one of the first ones is lying. If you are dating a young man and you catch him lying to his mother, what should you do? Run, because he will also lie to you. If he tells his mom, "Oh, we're going to go to the store, we're going to go get pizza," then we are actually planning on going somewhere else. If a man will lie to his family, he will lie to you. So you need to run as fast as you can. There are others: drug abuse, anger outbursts, temper issues. There are actually seven red flags that young ladies need to understand and have a list written out. And if they find a young man who's interested in them, who has any one of these issues, the answer is close the door and run. But I used to go over some of those with our girls at summer camp. Some of them here might even remember some of those Christian living lessons that we covered, character flaws. That, by the way, there are also some for young ladies, but we won't go through those because that's not the subject today. Today is this one. So we'll talk about those later. So Amnon said to Tamar, verse 10, "Bring the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand." So Tamar took the cakes with which she had made, brought them to Amnon, her brother, in the bedroom. Now when she had brought them to her, he took hold of her and said, "Come with me, my sister, come lie with me." And this is the answer young ladies ought to have. If someone says, "Let's move in together," or "Let's start enjoying fornication," this is the answer. "No, do not force me, for no such thing should be done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." So my advice to all young ladies who are still single, memorize this verse. Know how to yell it out loud as you can, because you will get the chance. Young men should memorize it too, because they are often the subject of predatory behavior by women in our society who also lack morals and a fear of God. So we have this young lady who unfortunately then ended up being forcibly raped and then publicly humiliated, but she understood a very powerful truth about what God thinks about this type of behavior. She said simply, "It's a disgraceful thing. Let's please don't do this." In the society we are in, I want to go over now to Job chapter 31. You know, the Bible's full of a lot of threes because we can remember three things at once. We can't remember four. We talked about that some at one of the Bible studies we did this Northwest weekend. You know, Winston Churchill gave a speech. We all think it was blood, sweat, and tears. It wasn't. It was blood, toil, sweat, and tears. But the human mind, essentially, can remember three things, but cannot remember four. And so we don't have a long list of four. God has many, many lists of threes. Pride of life, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes. So many threes Jesus Christ told us in his teaching, so did Paul. So we have kind of a number three here. But in this case, we have Job 31, and in a very wonderful verse that he gave to us, he went over some of the things that he had done so that he would not be enticed by a woman. Men have to have a plan. We live in a society where there is way too much on display. We live in a society where, unfortunately, a lot of people that should know better in the Church of God are not able or for some reason not willing to comply with. It's a big problem every year at the Feast of Tabernacles where it's in a warm climate and there's a beach. We have young ladies that know better wearing horribly improper clothing. Sometimes I know one of the good friend of mine that coordinates a feast in Mexico said every other day during the feast he has to remind people, the young ladies, to dress properly, to dress modestly. Because for some reason, the tendency is there to simply want to flaunt, want to get attention, want to say, look at me, whatever it is. Job chapter 31, verse 9, Job said, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind forever, and let others bow down to her. So Job basically understood very clearly that his heart was not to be enticed by another woman. And how did he do that? What was his plan to remain obedient to God? It's in verse 1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? I wonder how many young men today, how many older men pray and ask God to help them make a covenant with their eyes, that they would not look on something that is improper, or that is impure, or that is simply wrong. It is something that all men need help with. And the challenges are there. It's a world that's full of opportunity for lust. When I think about all the things that have happened over the years, a number of years ago, my daughter and her husband, Jonathan, were just married, I think, for their first year married, got married in February, so this would have been, I think, the first feast. We went to France. A good friend, Tim Pebbers, was the France coordinator there. And we went to Normandy before the feast, and we were able to go through the gun emplacements and take a wonderful tour of all the landing beaches and the events in Normandy. And I sort of had a running contest with the tour guide as to who could remember which units under what generals landed where and what took place. And I will say that the tour guide was mildly impressed that I'd read that many books and understood much about what had gone on. But I don't want to go somewhere unless I've studied it and I can gain all I can out of it. When we went to the tour of Israel for the ministerial tour in 2009, we went with the Sephorics and a number of others. I had printed all of the pages from the Biblic Archaeology Review magazine. On every location we were going, I had printed out all the articles about that place. I had done all my research. I had it all in a three-ring notebook, which I'd already read, but I had it there for anybody else to read so that when we went to all these various places in Israel, they would understand when you were looking at what was unearthed and what was on display, where it came from, how it was unearthed, and the various things that the archaeologists had said about it. So it was the same thing when we went to France. Now, the French feast site was down on the southern coast. It was an early feast, so it was early in the year. It was in late September. And, of course, the beaches were what they are in Europe. So I talked to Mr. Pebworth about family day when people were all going to go down to the beach and play games. I said, how are we going to get away from, you know, all this public nudity going on at the beaches in you know, down here? Because he asked my son-in-law and me and my wife to kind of help set up some of the games and things. So he said, there's a place down there by the jetty where nobody swims. It's clean. It's away from everybody else. It'll be great for us. So he told me how to get there. He said, you leave the hall, you go down this road, you turn right, and then when you get down to this other road, you turn left, and then that beach is right there. So Jonathan and I headed down with our supplies, and we're going to go down and set up these volleyball nets and various balloon tossing and games. Only I took a wrong turn. And so we got down to the beach, and there's a half mile of naked people between us and where we're supposed to be. And I'm with my son-in-law, who is married to my daughter. I thought, this is, you know, God, get me out of this, please. You know, beam me up, Scotty, get me, whatever. So I said, Jonathan, we're going that direction, and you and I are going to look straight ahead. To the jetty, we're looking way above the jetty. We're not going to turn to the right or to the left. Ready, set, go. And so we just, as fast as we could, went down through a half mile of all these people laying on the beach, whatever. I thought, that's just disgusting. Public nudity is a sign of paganism. What did Christopher Columbus discover when he got to the New World? Cannibalism, paganism, human sacrifice. How many have read his diaries? Do it sometime. If you wonder what the real New World was like when Christopher Columbus arrived, he left his brother on San Salvador Island because the cannibalism was so bad. You know, they had stockades. The first thing they found were stockades, fences. And behind the fences were young boys who had been castrated who were being fed until they could be slaughtered like hogs. And that plus the public nudity and the sacrifice of children was, and of adults was common all during the New World. Africa still has huge numbers of pagan people that simply don't wear clothes. It has been the Christian and the English-speaking peoples, primarily the Christian, Judeo-Christian peoples, that have understood morality, that have understood respect for women, have understood respect for the human form that God created. So Christopher Columbus really did bring civilization to the New World. And of course, we're going to be part of bringing a new civilization to the entire earth when Jesus Christ returns. But having said all that, my son-in-law did get down to where we were supposed to be. We did get the game set up, and we had a pretty successful day. And I never went back to that beach. I thought, this is, I'm here for the feast, keep God's feast. I'm not going back to a place. Because, like Job said, men have to make a covenant with their eyes, which means staying off pornography. Cell phones, two clicks, three clicks on a computer, you can be the most evil in the entire earth. And just simply, it's you know, Satan's playground. He loves it, and too many men in God's church have fallen prey to it. As prey, it simply doesn't happen. We all know what happened to King David. He didn't make a covenant with his eyes. There was a young lady who was, unfortunately, taking a bath in public. We don't know why she was doing that. Bible doesn't say. But he ended up paying a horrible penalty because he didn't make a covenant with his eyes, but instead gave into it. I want to go now to let's look at some history first, and then we'll go back to some New Testament scriptures. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 29. Genesis chapter 29. If someone tells you that adultery, fornication, is penalty-free, this is a great place to confute that. A great place to show that is simply wrong. Genesis chapter 29 and verse 30. Jacob went to Rachel, and Jacob also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served Laban 7 years for her. So we have Jacob having Rachel as his wife. Leah conceived and bore a son and called his name Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn of Leah, the first wife of Jacob. Reuben should have received all the blessings that God gave to Abraham and Isaac and then to Jacob. Reuben should have, but why didn't he? What did he lose? Let's drop down a little bit farther. Let's go down to chapter 35 and verse 16. Chapter 35 and verse 16, they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was a little distance to Ephraim, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. It came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said, "Don't fear, you'll have this son," which she did. Her son was named Benjamin, but she died in childbirth. So Jacob was in mourning. What happened? Verse 22. It happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. So she was a concubine. She was not a loved wife. And so she apparently, for whatever reason, they got in this relationship with this man named Reuben. And what did it cost Reuben? What did a one-night fling with this woman that was his father's concubine cost him? Is it cheap? Is it easy? Like you would find by reading or by watching everything on television or reading various novels or various stories. Let's go to Genesis 49. Genesis 49 and verse 1. Jacob called his sons together right before he died. He's in the land of Egypt, saying, "Gather together that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days." And he says in verse 3, "Reuben, you are my firstborn." He says, "You're my might and my strength. You are the little baby boy I've been waiting for all these years, and I was so proud of you. The excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. You should have all the birthright. You should have all the blessings of Abraham, the greatness of many nations, a crown, the rulership under your dynasty." But he says, "You're unstable as water. You shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it." So what did Reuben lose? The greatest blessings in all history. How big is France compared to the British Empire in the United States? How big is what little Reuben has had all during his time? I think it also perhaps has some modern-day applications with the French being very quickly defeated in battle so many times by the Germans and by others, losing Vietnam, other things. Reuben simply lost blessings incalculable in trillions of dollars, perhaps even more than that. The greatest price ever paid for a one-night stand or for violating very easy principle to understand, thou shalt not commit adultery. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, the New Testament is full of so many admonitions to obey God. In the five lists of sins that we are to avoid, four of them begin with adultery. The fifth one has adultery second. So it is very, very important in the New Testament teachings, in God's teachings. Ephesians chapter 5 in verse 20 or 32. Let's go to chapter or verse 32. "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning church, Christ and the church. Let each one of us, as you love, in particular his wife, as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." But verse 32 tells us it is about the marriage. It reflects Jesus Christ and the church. So the marriage relationship, the one that a man has with his wife, pictures Jesus Christ and the church. That's why husbands are not to abuse their wives or to criticize them or beat them down, and wives the same way. It is to be a mutual admiration society. Jesus Christ forgives us. We are to forgive each other, not hold it as a grudge or as a method of being intolerant or mean or cruel, because Jesus Christ and the church is not that in any way. But he begins this chapter in verse 1, "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children and walk in love." So what does it mean to be walk in love? "As Christ has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. But fornication and all uncleanness and covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for the saints." Let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for the saints. It is a tragic, painful, emotional experience when our young girls, who know better, they've been raised on the truth, many have gone to camp, heard it taught many, many times, hopefully they've developed a relationship with God, learned to pray and study, but they are vulnerable. They have the curse from Adam and Eve, Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. Their desire for a husband often becomes in their mind more strong than their desire to obey God. And it breaks my heart when they are picked off one at a time by Satan the devil and his agents out there who are coming after our girls like a bunch of vicious demons and just picking them off one after another and another. I want to hear these stories so often of our young ladies just moving in and cohabiting with some goon they met out somewhere, some agent of Satan the devil. It is tough because I know what they're doing to each other. I know what they're doing to their own life and what they are going to pay the penalty for. Even though they're in their little immature mind, they make excuses for it, and think it's okay, but the Bible is full of examples that there is a heavy penalty for pay. It is not good. And while just like God wants to bless us, have us have every good thing, if we go down the path that is self-destructive, that penalty is sure and is not going to be avoided. Fornication and all uncleanness, let it not even be named once among the saints. That's God's instruction. Neither foolishness or filthiness nor coarse jesting, which is not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks. In verse 11, he says, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. There's too much fellowshipping going on with unfruitful works of darkness. There are too many people that you allow in your home through a screen that you would not allow through the front door. But you watch their activities. We pay money sometimes on things like Netflix, which I've canceled because of all the things they have on there that, even though I didn't go to them, I just know they're there. I want to just not even see them. So we allow people into our living rooms that we wouldn't allow in through our front door, but we allow them in through these screens that broadcast things that are simply broadcast messages of the fellowship of darkness. Because verse 12 said, it is shameful to even speak of those things which are done by them in secret. If Paul had written today, he would have said it's shameful to view those things that are evil and are done by them in secret. Because everything you see puts an impression in your mind, and you might think you can somehow view through it, but the truth of the matter is we can't. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, because the Bible is replete with admonitions that we are to be as virgins in the eyes of God. We are familiar with that. We all know that Jesus Christ is going to return. His bride is to be a virgin prepared for him. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2, 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, if I make you sorry, I'm sorry, that's the wrong chapter. I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Jesus Christ. We are to be part of the bride of Christ that has been clothed in white and made ourselves ready. And they understood in that culture that young ladies were to be married as virgins, and in fact they were to have that celebrated at their wedding. During the years that I've been doing weddings, and I very much enjoy them, they're certainly better than funerals, memorials, but I've only had one young lady that actually wore a promise ring that her father had given to her when she was, 11, 12, that as she went up the aisle and her father gave her away, she took off her promise ring and gave it to her dad and said, Dad, I have kept my promise, which means she was walked up the aisle as a virgin. And she replaced that promise ring with a wedding ring that said, now I am married to my husband. And I just wanted to cheer. I just wanted to stand up and clap, yeah, this is great. Why don't all of our girls do that? Why don't they make a promise, a covenant with their father, that they will be married as a virgin instead of finding some goon out in the street who looks nice, who has a cool personality, maybe a nice car, and then go and shack up, damage goods for the rest of their life. It's one of those things that Satan loves, but I tell you, doing it the right way brings joy that's just almost immeasurable. So I remember walking my daughter down the aisle, and she had done things the right way, and I told her she could have any wedding she wanted. It cost me a year's salary. It cost me more than I make in a year as a minister. Thankfully, we had some savings, and my wife works, has some extra income, but that's the best money I ever spent. Happiest day of my life, walking my daughter up the aisle as a virgin. I was proud of her. I bought dinner for 190 people I never met before, so it was expensive. Best money, I'd do it again tomorrow if I had the same opportunity. Why do these young ladies forget their family? Why do they not understand how they're dishonoring their family, dishonoring their church family, dishonoring their minister who loves them, not like a father, but like a pastor? If they had any idea how much time, how much effort I have spent the last 30 years at summer camps. My first summer camp was in Big Sandy, 1975. I was 2 years old. No, I wasn't. I was 8. No, I was 21. I was teaching water skiing. But ever since then, we've gone to camp over and over and over. I directed camp for 15, 16 years, and we taught the kids over and over and over, pleaded with them. Do it God's way. Don't violate the seventh commandment. It's far more important, far more valuable than you'll ever know. And so most of them do it right. I really appreciate them, and we're proud of them. But when they go the other direction, it is heartbreaking for everyone who knows them. It's heartbreaking for their families. And they're going to be paying a penalty in many years to come, even though at the time they don't understand it. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 tells us, I'm sorry, chapter 11 says we are to be presented as a bride of Jesus Christ, a virgin. Now there's one book of the Bible that is all about preparing as a bride for Christ. The whole subject of the book is a bride keeping herself chaste until she's married. Anyone know what that is? It's pretty simple. It's called the Song of Solomon. Now, I'll give you a little hint. The Song of Solomon is not about sex. No sex going on in the book. The Song of Solomon is not about Christ and the church. Every book you've read from these Protestant authors who don't know diddly squat about the Song of Solomon have taught you diddly squat. The book is about the three temptations of Solomon coming to this bride who was betrothed to somebody else. And she thinks about her beloved beyond the curtains. She thinks about him and says, I'm going to be loyal to him. And Solomon goes back. It's the same as the three trials of Jesus Christ in Matthew 4 and verse and chapter 4 and Luke 4. It's the same as the pride of life, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. It's the same three trials you will all go through. The book is about the trials we as Christians go through as we are preparing to be the bride of Christ. Now, if someone is writing a book that will tell the truth about Song of Solomon, it's never been taught. And I hope to be finished with that book within a few months. I've got it half done. But let's go to Song of Solomon, chapter 8, and verse 8. It's amazing that there's this book of the Bible that has universally been misunderstood. United Church of God has nothing written on it. Simply don't. The books that are out there in public bookstores are just simply wrong. They're just simply not correct at all. The idea that Song of Solomon was about sex didn't even come out with until the 1500s. That's when the idea first came about. The Jews have long understood it was not about that. Song of Solomon, the last chapter, chapter 8, beginning in verse 8, this is where the young lady who has resisted the three temptations of Solomon, just like Jesus Christ resisted the three temptations of Satan the devil, she's ready to be married. She says, and they said, this is the brothers. They are the family who are giving her away as a chaste virgin bride. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. They're looking back now. They're talking back about when she was small. Just like my grandma told my brother, nah, you got to protect her until she is able to be given in marriage to a man who will protect her. It says, what shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? What will you do for your sister until the day when she's married? If she is a wall, we will build upon her. What is a wall? A wall keeps intruders out, just like intruders ought to be kept out of the lives of our beautiful young girls. If she's a wall, we'll build upon her a battlement of silver. If she's a door, which means she's opened herself to these young men, we will enclose her with boards of cedar, a casket. A lot of difference, isn't there? Being decorated with silver or being put in a casket. They'll simply walk away from her, they'll disown her. What does a young lady say if she's about to get married? I am a wall. I am a virgin. I have kept all of those influences away. And my breasts like towers. And it's not to do with the size. This is not Dolly Parton in Scripture. This is meaning they've been defended. Nobody has violated me. She's telling her husband, nobody has violated me. I've been a tower. Towers were the most protected part of walls. And when walls were around a city. I became in his eyes as one who found peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hermon, and he leased the vineyard out to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. Verse 12, my own vineyard is before me. She resisted the vineyards that were offered to her, men who were already married or were improper in some way. And she says, nope, I chose my vineyard before I even saw him. You see, what's neat about the Song of Solomon, she never sees the one she's marrying until her wedding day. Just like we have never seen Jesus Christ, we will not until our wedding day. So I don't mean to give the whole book away at once, but... And she says, you, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend his fruit, 200. But to her beloved now, she changes and says to her beloved, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions listen for your voice, let me hear it. In other words, you are there. And then she says, make haste, my beloved, be like a gazelle, O young stag, on the mountains of spices. So she's celebrating that she's now being able to get married. Her husband is coming, and they shall go together like deer running across the hill. The important thing of being a virgin at marriage is in God's eyes of paramount importance. Sadly, we have lost that in our society, and more sadly than that, we have too many who have compromised and think it's okay, because our society thinks it's okay, and society wears on us and wears on us and wears on us. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 tells us that those who commit adultery, fornication, porneia, which simply means a violation of sexual rules, those who do that sin against their own body. Doesn't say that about stealing, doesn't say it about the other commandments, although it sort of does with the parents. If you honor your father and your mother, you'll live long upon the earth. The implication is if you don't, you won't live as long, certainly won't have as many blessings. But this is the only place, the only commandment that a man sins against his own body is clearly stated. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 13. Food for the stomach and the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them. The body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Everything we do should be for the glory of God, not for the satisfaction of self or the gratification of lust. Sexual immorality is simply prohibited. The body is simply not for it. God has both raised up the Lord and will also raise up us by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of the Christ, of Jesus Christ? Shall I then take members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Answer is certainly not. It tells you very plainly what God meant in verse 16, that the two shall become one flesh. Verse 18 is what he's getting to. Flee sexual immorality. It means run. It means like Joseph did with Potiphar's wife. Leave your clothes if you have to and run as fast as you can. It doesn't mean toy with it. It doesn't mean, you know, try a little bit here and there. It means run. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Now, what are the consequences? What kind of sin is he talking about? Well, the honest answer is that the consequences of unwanted pregnancy are bad, but pregnancy is a natural process. The consequences of venereal disease are bad, but the medical establishment seems to have ways of, you know, dealing with some of that. The worst consequence of immorality, of living together, of sexual activity outside of marriage, which I've explained till I'm blue in the face to groups, but also youngsters, teenagers, the worst penalty, the way you damage your own body, as it says here, is called a seared conscience, because repeated sexual acts simply burn your conscience to where it doesn't exist anymore, and no longer are you able to make the right kind of decisions. What's the worst thing that could happen if you commit adultery? It's very plain in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2. You can have your conscience seared with a hot iron. Now, is that just me making this up, or would other people also agree with that? Here's what I read last week in Bible study, the World Affairs Brief. This is a worldwide known writer, and he got this by Joel Skousen. And he says this, sexual and gender lunacy is spreading like wildfire, along with the other sexually transmitted diseases that go along with indiscriminate and unsanitary practices. We are becoming fast like Sodom and Gomorrah, ripe for destruction. And of course, he says there's a growing satanic comment, but then he says this, Immorality doesn't come without chronic violations of the promptings and warnings of conscience. The end result of that chronic bad judgment about everyday habits and decisions in life, the root cause of most poverty, failed marriages, and juvenile delinquency today. All this leads to a bigger national problem, the loss of blessings and protections from God. So he's simply saying that repeated immorality, repeated lewd, out-of-marriage sex acts cause a lack of conscience and an inability to make normal, good judgments in life. So when the Bible says it's a sin against our own flesh, the Bible is very clear and knows exactly what it is talking about. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 3. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 3. This is the will of God, you being set apart, your sanctification. Jesus Christ called us to set us apart, not to just leave us as part of the world. We live in the world, we're not a part of it. We are ambassadors of a different kingdom. That you should abstain from sexual immorality. The Roman Empire was rife with it. And so what did Paul say here? Very clearly, you should abstain from sexual immorality. He wrote that to the Corinthians several times. That each of you should know how to possess his own vessel or his wife in sanctification and honor. So young men should know, be taught, should learn as they're growing up, how to find a wife and how to possess her in sanctification and honor. Not in passion of lust like the Gentiles who don't know God. Our relationships are not to be based on the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God. But sadly, too often that happens. No one should take advantage and defraud his brother in this manner, because the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also forewarned you and testified. Remember what God told Abimelech? You commit adultery, I'll kill you. What does the Apostle Paul say? Don't go abroad, don't go beyond and defraud your brother, the man who will marry her someday, because God is the avenger of all such. God doesn't change. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. I also want to go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. I've been in some discussions this week about the application of this chapter. I wrote some letters to some of the ministers I'm under in authority and working with. In 1 Corinthians, Paul is dealing with a very serious situation, as you know from reading the book. To begin with, there was factions. There was also an immoral individual who was openly living with his apparently mother-in-law, or at least his father's stepmom, perhaps. Verse 1, there's actual sexual immorality among you, that such sexual immorality is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. You are rather puffed up and have not mourned. So this church, affected by the society around them, lost their ability to judge. They wanted to be caring, they wanted to be accepting, they wanted to be nice, they wanted to make them feel welcome. Oh, we don't want to drive them away from the church. In fact, they're already acting like that means they've already left. But all of the words that are used in our modern day society to justify not obeying God were used back then. Things haven't changed, except the faces have changed. So we have people who say, oh, well, let's just, you know, be nice to them, let's go ahead and visit with them, let's go ahead and make them feel welcome, on and on and on it goes, even though they are flaunting their disobedience of God. Paul said, as indeed, as absent in body but present in spirit, have already judged. Paul says, I don't need to know any more than this. I have already judged exactly what should be done. And so he tells us that they should be delivered to, they should not be allowed to attend, and they should be delivered to Satan so that someday perhaps God could bring them to repentance and save their flesh. Now in verse 9 he continues, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean the sexually immoral of this world or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since you would then need to go out of the world. You couldn't go to Costco or Walmart if you tried to avoid everybody who was in this behavior. But he says those who are pretending to be church members, or I think also in the context of church activities and the organized activities and services that we have, those who obviously know better because they were at one time a part of us. either growing up or members who used to be. He says, I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater, or reviler, or drunkard, or extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging those also who are outside? Do not judge those who are inside. So the application of this verse is very difficult because it's one that we have shied away from often, and sadly, in the history of the Church of God. We want to make concessions. It takes courage to obey God sometimes. We don't want to offend people or make them feel upset. But honestly, when we have church services where we are convened here to worship God, or church activities where we are together to fellowship, to have iron sharpening iron, to exchange our love of God's truth and why we are there, in those venues, we should not have people who know better and have been raised better but are openly flaunting the truth of God. They're flaunting their sin. There's no such thing as secrets. Just simply, the Bible even says that. If you say something in secret, some bird will fly and tell it to the king. In our group, there's no such thing as secrets. All the teens, the young adults, it's amazing the things that they know that they think nobody else knows. But the answer here is pretty clear. If there is someone in that category who is simply living in sin openly, knowing better, they shouldn't be at organized church activities or at church. It's not easy if they're relatives. It's not easy if they're friends. It's not easy if they're people we have liked and loved in previous years. But why do people do that? Why do people who know better decide to flaunt the violation of the marriage covenant, to openly violate the seventh commandment? Well, the answer is very simple. It's over in Romans chapter 3 and verse 18. Romans chapter 3, verse 18. It says very plainly, there is no fear of God before their eyes. They simply have lost the fear of God. They've lost the fear of being alone, or they've loved the fear of being alone. They have this fear of this person they think that they want to have this relationship with. They will compromise God's truth to make somebody else happy, meaning themselves. You know, Matthew 10 and verse 26, we won't turn there because you know it. Jesus Christ said, fear him who is able to send you to the lake of fire. He said, don't fear man. What can man do to you? The only one you should fear is the being who can send you to the lake of fire, which is God Almighty. And of course, Jesus Christ has been given all judgment. So when people no longer have a fear of God and they flaunt their evil behavior, they shouldn't be at church activities. They shouldn't be in church services. Because we want to protect our people here, especially our young ladies who are so beautiful and our young men who are so beautiful. We want to protect them from bad influences. We don't want to make them think it's okay when it's not okay. Am I clear, or should I repeat that? I have full approval from everybody I've talked to this week on up the chain to say exactly that. And I hope someday it is administered uniformly across the Church of God, because 1 Corinthians 5 has not been in my 60 years in the church, 52 years. So I think it's time we started obeying it, because God holds us responsible to obey him. I want to finish today over in James chapter 1. The law of God is the law of love. It's also the law of liberty. Because liberty is freedom, but freedom has boundaries. Freedom isn't just to do whatever you want. You're not your own authority to decide what is right and wrong. Freedom is true freedom. And freedom, obviously, is one of those things where we must understand that there is a fence around us called the law of God. And that is a fence of liberty. We have real life, real freedom, hope in the future, a kingdom to look forward to, and blessings unbounded during this life if we live within that fence. If we break the law, we think we are, but we really aren't. The law is breaking us. Just throw an egg against the wall and say, well, using this egg, I'm going to break the wall. It doesn't happen. Because the law of God is immutable, and those who think they are breaking it are truly breaking themselves. James chapter 1 and verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and all overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. So if we receive into our minds properly the implanted word of God, then we're going to be avoiding wickedness, avoiding evil. Verse 22, be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. And of course, if he doesn't, he goes away and forgets what manner of person that he was. Verse 27 tells us, pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this, to visit orphans and the father, and to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And so we live the law of liberty, keeping ourselves unspotted from the world, and indeed we look forward to a kingdom that is coming where everyone is going to be a virgin bride prepared for Jesus Christ. It's one of those things that we must understand in a broad context, that our relationship with the one we are either married to now or are going to marry someday has to reflect the relationship of Jesus Christ, God the Father, and us in the church, or else simply loses its meaning, and we then have lost the calling that God has given to us. The good news is, doing it God's way brings blessings forevermore. At the right hand of God are blessings and pleasures forevermore, says in Psalm chapter 16. So with that, let's think about how important it is. Think about the laws of God and how much they are a blessing. And don't forget the first dream of the Bible and the lesson we are to learn from it.